Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. All complex systems have certain characteristics in common: parallel processes, network supply and production, and waste loops in which occasionally some system's output is actually another system's substrate. Like, for example, plants producing oxygen as their waste product and breathing in our own waste, CO2, as their food. And the final, more or less universal feature of complex systems is, of course, feedback loops and signaling, which exists to stabilize the system so that all the players are dancing to the same tune. Today, we're going to explore signaling and feedback in a variety of contexts, from brainwaves to DNA to cooperation between different species of bacteria. You'll see that there are many parallels with the rules and strategies taken by these different complex systems. It is not an exaggeration to say that current imaging, genetic, and biochemical analysis is creating an era of nuanced intervention, perhaps verging on reprogramming those divergent systems that are the fundamental basis for disease and dysfunction. We'll start with a discussion of bacterial systems and cooperation and communication, and also ostracism of bacteria that don't play by the rules. In natural microbial communities, different bacterial species often exchange nutrients by releasing amino acids and vitamins into their growth environment and thus feeding other bacterial cells. Even though the released nutrients are energetically costly to produce, bacteria benefit from nutrients that their bacterial partners provide in return. Think of this process as a cooperative exchange of special skills. Specialization, like, for example, one blacksmith and one baker, and you start to have a village. There's a research group called Experimental Ecology and Evolution, headed by a Dr. Christian Coast, and they're investigating how cooperative interactions between organisms have evolved. In this context, the scientists study a special type of division of labor that's very common in nature, called the reciprocal exchange of nutrients among unicellular bacteria. For these tiny organisms, it's advantageous to divide the labor of certain metabolic processes rather than performing all the biochemical functions by themselves. Bacteria that engage in this cooperative exchange of nutrients can save a significant amount of energy. With some of this energy, they build specialized coral reefs called biofilms for their habitat. But what about non-cooperating bacteria that come in and consume amino acids without providing nutrients in return? Left unchecked, the evolutionary disadvantage that resulted for the cooperative cells could lead to a collapse of the cross-breeding interaction. So to experimentally verify this possibility, the scientists have monitored co-cultures of cooperating and non-cooperating bacteria. To do this, they genetically engineered cooperators of two bacterial species that released increased amounts of certain amino acids into their environment. As a matter of fact, non-cooperators grew better than cooperators in a well-mixed liquid medium because under these conditions, they had an unrestricted access to the amino acids in the medium. Their growth, however, was considerably reduced when placed on a two-dimensional surface, which mimics how most bacterial colonies exist. Detailed analysis revealed that the biofilms excluded the non-cooperating bacteria and that they could only live on the edges of the colonies. The exact mechanism for the exclusion of the parasitic bacteria to the periphery of the biofilm has not been fully figured out. But bacteria do exist primarily in biofilms, which are kind of surface-attached slime layers, and they have many bacterial species within them as a general rule. Known examples of this would be dental plaque, or the bacterial communities that are used productively to process wastewater. Biofilms play a highly important role in many infectious diseases, particularly persistent ones that are difficult to treat, like sinusitis and prostatitis. In this limited experimental model, the cooperating bacteria formed cell clusters and in this way excluded the non-cooperating bacteria from their community. part of the importance of this scientific experiment is to show that the cooperativity and exchange of nutrients is a basic condition into which the bacteria naturally fall under wild-type circumstances. Of course, in the wild, it's much more complex, and there would be rather more than two bacterial species participating in the cooperative interactions, so there might be very complex interaction networks. The suggestion of this experiment is that cooperative cross-feeding and complex interaction between bacteria in biofilms is likely the rule rather than the exception. Understanding the factors and mechanisms that promote and inhibit bacterial growth could thus provide important clues about how to fight harmful bacteria or to better use beneficial ones. In functional medicine, we often use proteolytic enzymes to disrupt biofilms in cases of sinusitis, for example. I'm now going to have to question whether or not the use of these materials might actually disrupt biofilms that I want to keep intact in my patients. As usual, the puzzle gets deeper and deeper. Every layer of the onion you peel reveals a new layer. Epigenetics is another form of complex system that we are just beginning to understand. And oh my, the complexity and layers of onion skin there are probably astronomical. Recent research, however, looking exactly, specifically at prenatal influences on the parents, has revealed some interesting information. And we discussed this a few weeks ago on the program, so I'll just allude to it briefly. Both the maternal and, this is new, the paternal diet prior to conception have an influence on not just the weight of the offspring, but also the offspring's disposition emotionally. The anxiety levels in offspring rats were higher in those that were fathered by male rats who had had abundant or excessive food. This seems a little counterintuitive to me. I would expect that food shortage would cause more anxiety in the offspring, but in fact, the opposite is true. I think the take-home lesson here, well, there are actually several. One of them is that the feedback loops are independent of time. In the bacterial communities, they were more or less simultaneous feedback loops occurring over a short time frame and feeding back on itself rapidly. In the case of epigenetics, however, we're talking about communication occurring across generations and across large chunks of time. Adaptations that were signaled by events of decades previously, but that still cling to the genetic imprinting that epigenetic creates. The other take-home lesson for me is that things don't always come out logically in science, and in fact, sometimes, as in this case, it seems almost counterintuitive that you'd get a particular outcome. And that's why we always have to test. Testing is critical in science. You can't assume you know what the outcome is going to be. Evolution by mutation is too slow to deal with rapid change in the environment, so epigenetic mechanisms evolved, at least partially, to create a reversible, turn-on-a-dime sort of change in the DNA that was going to be expressed, which allows for adaptation over a single generation. Talk about big surprises that we didn't expect. The Genome Project taught us that there were about 30,000 genes. This is far less than many simpler organisms. But it is because of the advanced vocabulary, the grammar, if you will, that epigenetics provides, that we can get by with such a small genetic dictionary. Think of it as if there are 30,000 nouns to our genetic blueprint. But epigenetic changes are the verbs and adjectives. And sometimes, as in this next story, they just say, "Not now." The next story is about a type of epigenetic modification we haven't talked about that much, called zinc fingers. Zinc fingers are a type of epigenetic on and off switch that control about 800 individual genes. They're called zinc fingers because of the shape that the protein forms around the zinc cofactor. But more importantly, if you look them up, you'll find that they're being used for genetic splicing and genetic manipulation. And were, in fact, prior to the advent of the CRISPR-Cas9 apparatus that we've talked about extensively this last year, they were probably the hottest way to get this done. But rather than talking about them as a tool, let's discuss how they work in this particular situation, which is to say, delaying the onset of puberty. A handful of the 800 individual genes that are controlled by zinc fingers are critical for controlling the onset of puberty, according to a recent paper published in the journal Nature Communications. Effectively, the zinc fingers sit on genes, preventing them from being activated in the hypothalamus and thus delaying the onset of puberty. When this mechanism fails to work, you have precocious puberty. In fact, most of the zinc finger family are genetic suppressors or repressors. So what's going on with the global trend towards earlier and earlier puberty? Well, one suspicion is that chemical substances contained in human-made products, such as phthalates or BPA, are likely antagonizing the function of the zinc fingers and allowing puberty to turn on in the hypothalamus earlier than nature intended. The researchers were able to elucidate the mechanism of puberty in quite some detail. And basically what happens is that messenger RNAs coding for several zinc fingers decrease during the transition into puberty, thus removing the brake on the hypothalamic drive to begin transcribing the signals which ultimately stimulate the production of luteinizing hormone and follicle-stimulating hormone and lead to the onset of puberty in mammals. The researchers were also able to manipulate the abundance of these zinc finger products by putting extra messenger RNA into some of the prepubescent female rats that they were studying, and they found that they could delay puberty indefinitely under those circumstances. Now, that's very relevant to our next story. So, want to talk science fiction? Let's talk about the possibility of drastically prolonging human life by the simple expedient of delaying puberty. This is another study that we covered earlier this year, but I couldn't resist putting it back into this context because it fits so well. This study was looking at the onset of aging, and they were studying a roundworm, C. elegans, which is commonly used for genetic testing and scientific study. The researchers determined that at the time that the worm reaches sexual maturity, several very important mechanisms that would ordinarily protect the organism from aging turn themselves down. And the ultimate result of this is that with puberty onset and the start of reproduction, the animal actually begins to die. The factor that is changed at puberty that leads ultimately to the demise of the organism is a compound called heat shock protein. The heat shock response is essential for proper protein folding and cellular health. Aging has long been associated with a decline in quality control of protein and also in a lessening of the heat shock response. What the researchers found was that this critical protective mechanism, which is present in a superb state of functionality in the worm prior to the onset of reproductive capacity, declines rapidly about 8 hours into adulthood, leading to a repression of not just the heat shock response, but a host of other protective and reparative functions that simply become less functional in C. elegans as soon as reproduction starts. While it might be possible to turn this genetic switch back on in post-pubescent animals like ourselves, it's interesting to speculate that the key to eternal youth may in fact be eternal youth. Maybe Peter Pan got it right after all. Another very interesting aspect of signaling that we've been finding out in the last few years is that RNA is actually an important regulatory and functional compound. It does a lot of jobs. Now, most of us who took high school biology may remember the messenger RNA, which is essentially the mold of the DNA that goes off to the ribosome to make a protein. And you may remember the transfer RNA, which was just a little RNA shuttle device that took an amino acid and plugged it in to the choo-choo train that is the protein as it's being extruded by the ribosome. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. A great deal of the genome, the part that is not coding for proteins and was usually called junk DNA before we understood what an important regulatory role it has, most, if not all of that, does single or possibly double or triple duty, moving things, building things, turning things off, turning things on, and acting as a signaling compound. We recently discussed an article where this was a proof of concept. This was a study looking at blocking a type of RNA that was in high abundance in rat brains after artificially induced stroke. What the researchers noticed was that a particular long segment of quote-unquote non-coding DNA would get transcribed into RNA, but then instead of migrating to the ribosome, it stayed in the cytoplasm of cells doing, well, who knows what. The researchers decided to block this RNA. Having identified this long string of RNA that seemed to be turning on certain other genes, or at least regulating their activity in the post-stroke rat brain, they designed an anti-sense strand, essentially an anti-coded string of RNA that would attach, like Velcro, to the long strings of RNA in question and prevent them from folding up or doing whatever it was that they were supposed to be doing. When the researchers did that, they found to their surprise that the amount of damage that occurred in their stroke model was substantially reduced by a significant 30% in the rats who had had that single string of RNA taken out of action. Now, the reason this looks really good as a medical therapy is that this silencing antisense RNA could be injected into the veins and find its way into the brain of these animals where it acted to reduce the production of the damage. Obviously, there are more than one potential signaling mechanism to be gone after here. Still, this speaks to the idea that I mentioned earlier, that we may be able to find the levers for reprogramming certain feedback loops that we'd really like to shut down. Natural genetic mutations serve as living laboratories to allow us to explore these interactions and co-signaling which is occurring in entities who are not affected by these genetic manipulations. A good example here is a mutation in the sodium channel in nerves. People afflicted by this NaV1.7 mutation have a congenital inability to feel pain, but they do experience normal touch, light touch, and moderate amounts of heat and cold. They just don't feel pain when they burn themselves. People born with this mutation have been studied since 2006, and one of the interesting things that's emerged is that people who lack NaV1.7 and therefore are unable to feel pain actually have higher than normal levels of enkephalins, one of the endogenous opiates, sometimes also referred to as endorphins, a term you'll probably be more familiar with. The researchers wondered whether or not these high levels of opiates were important for the painlessness that people with NaV1.7 experience. So they tried giving an opiate blocker, naloxone, to a patient with this mutation. It was a surprise to everyone that for the first time in her life, after her injection of naloxone, this 39-year-old woman could experience pain. Now, ever since this gene was discovered, people have tried NaV1.7 blockers, but they haven't worked really very well as pain control drugs, so that thread was kind of dropped a few years ago. However, In a leap of brilliant logic, the researchers decided, well, if naloxone, which blocks opiates, helps this lady with NaV1.7 feel pain, maybe if we combine a NaV1.7 blocker and a little bit of extra opiates in a person who has a normal gene, we'll get an anti-pain effect. And indeed, they did. What's really striking about this is that the doses of opiates necessary to create this synergistic interaction with the NaV1.7 blockers is a very small dose, not enough, for example, to impair cognition or make you drowsy or constipated, some of the most frustrating side effects that we deal with chronic opiate use. This research should be moving to human trials in 2017. We may have a really useful synergy on our hands if these NaV1.7 blockers turn out to be as safe and effective as they appear to be in preliminary work. As I said before, we are getting into the threshold of being able to reprogram things therapeutically. In this story, a constructed molecular machine is able to reduce brain injury after cardiac arrest. There's a natural mechanism for protecting stressed brain cells during anoxia or cardiac arrest. It's called NRF2, NRF2. And ordinarily, this protein compound is bound in the cytoplasm to another protein called KEAP1. Free NRF2 goes to the nucleus, where it turns on the production of many anti-inflammatory genes and leads to the production of anti-inflammatory proteins that are protective to the brain. What the researchers were seeking to do here was enhance the impact of an existing genetic trigger that produces anti-inflammatory and neuroprotective proteins. But to do that, they had to figure out a way to get that KEAP1 protein to let go of the NRF2 so that it could migrate to the nucleus. They invented a molecular machine based on three components. The first one was a false ligand, essentially a decoy for KEAP1, so that it would grab onto that and release the NRF2 that it was holding onto, allowing that NRF2 then to diffuse into the nucleus. The second component of this molecular machine was a compound called TAT, a viral protein that opens cells up so that this peptide could get inside of the cells. A third component was an enzyme called calpain. Calpain had the important job of cutting TAT loose once the peptide was inside the cell, because the decoy couldn't work while attached to TAT. Calpain was activated by the intracellular pH in a stressed situation, such as anoxia, in which the pH of the cell drops. Therefore, we have a compound that only works under situations of anoxia or other forms of stress. And here's what gets really exciting. This compound can be given subcutaneously. You don't even need to have IV access. So it could become part of the first responder toolkit whenever a cardiac arrest occurs in the field. Hormones and neurotransmitters are also important examples of complex signaling in dynamics complex systems, such as our body and brain. In the brain, it's very common for there to be reciprocal inhibition at a particular location between certain neurotransmitters. For example, levels of serotonin may repress the release of dopamine. The more serotonin, the less dopamine, up to a point at which the high levels of serotonin cease to suppress the dopamine, and the dopamine begins to suppress the serotonin. Now, that's simple enough. But when you throw in the fact that there may be as many as a dozen neurotransmitters interacting in a particular neuron, you begin to see how incredibly complex the manipulation of the threshold for that neuron to fire becomes. In the brain, uncontrolled neuronal activity looks like, well, like an epileptic seizure. It is suppression and repression of activity that leads to the complicated neurologic activity that we recognize as coherent thought. A key link that has emerged in the last decade is the interaction between depression and inflammation. And in fact, it is this sort of feedback loop in that depression increases inflammation and inflammation increases depression. Clearly, this sort of feedback loop is broken. It's a feed-forward loop, and without other external suppressors active, it can run out of control. Effectively, we have a vicious cycle here, with depression triggering a local inflammatory response, which aggravates the depression. Stress and depression also interact in a vicious cycle. Stress can lead to depression in susceptible individuals, and then the depression, if not treated, of course, causes stress. This chronic stress stimulates the body's immune system to fight the stress as if it were a disease or infection. Revving up the immune system includes the inflammatory response, and over time, the chronic inflammation causes a variety of health problems. In a recent study testing the antidepressant drug Lexapro, otherwise known as escitalopram, researchers measured the blood levels of inflammatory substances as they treated people for depression. At the beginning of the study, average levels of all nine of the inflammatory substances were higher in depressed patients than in the healthy control group. They identified four substances that were statistically higher in the depressed group. Those substances were high-sensitivity C-reactive protein, which is highly associated with increased cardiovascular disease risk, tumor necrosis factor alpha, which is upregulated in rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune disease, and also up in various infections. IL-6, interleukin-6, which is elevated in infection and inflammation in general, and monocyte chemotactic protein 1, which of course calls monocytes or white blood cells to an area to fight an infection. All of these were raised in depressed patients without infection. They also measured neurotoxic compounds in the bloodstream. These were the two agents quinolinic acid and 3-hydroxykinurene. These fell by more than 50% during the 8 weeks of antidepressant therapy. Quinolinic acid is a toxic compound produced from tryptophan in angry activated immune cells. It acts as a neurotransmitter, attaching to the NMDA receptor, the same one that glutamate attaches to, and it leads to toxic overstimulation of the neurons and eventually burns out the neuron and leads to cell death. Elevated levels of quinolinic acid are seen in Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, ALS, Lyme's disease, and a host of other infections. Now, while this article is about citalopram, a Wikipedia search for natural inhibitors of quinolinic acid found that green tea catechins and curcumin, as well as certain non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, also block the ability of quinolinic acid to overstimulate nerve cells. Another good reason to drink green tea and eat curry. Developmental signaling is also phenomenally complex, requiring literally thousands of cells and chemicals to be present at the right place, at the right time, and in the right amounts over and over and over again for hundreds of days in order for all the organs to form from a single fertilized egg. Due to major advances in cardiac surgery, children with significant and serious congenital heart disease have a far better chance of surviving today than in previous decades. But some of these infants who recover from the repairs to their hearts show defects of delays in brain development. Why is that? Is it the rigors of open-heart surgery at so young an age? Is it the fact that the heart defect in utero could limit the nutrients and oxygen needed by the fetus' brain? Or could spontaneous genetic mutations cause congenital problems that affect both the heart and the brain through different mechanisms? Well, it turns out to be the third of these answers. In a exome sequence analysis of more than 1,200 children and their parents, looking at the Pediatric Cardiovascular Genetics Consortium's work at Harvard, they found that children with both congenital heart disease and neurodevelopment delays share certain genetic mutations that thwart the normal development of both the brain and the heart, more or less simultaneously. In these cases, the parents did not have these same defects in their genomes. These were de novo mutations that are highly expressed in the developing heart. The neurodevelopmental delays were found more commonly in children who had congenital heart disease plus some other birth defect, particularly abnormalities in the shape of the fingers or the ear. This suggests that we're homing in on a set of genes that have multiple different roles in multiple different tissues during development, such as limb tissue, brain tissue, and heart tissue. So far as we know, these genes are primarily involved in, as you would expect, morphogenesis, or the origin of shape, but also chromatin modification and transcriptional regulation are involved. One of the mutated genes is RBFOX2, which encodes a protein that regulates RNA splicing. Many of the children who were affected by multiple defects had mutations here as well. It would appear that there are multiple levels of failsafe that have to go wrong in order for these mutations to act. It may be possible that there are compensatory mechanisms that shield certain children who, while they test positive for the mutations, do not manifest with any heart disease or neurodevelopmental delay. At the end of these articles, there is always a little commentary about how this may someday lead to the development of a drug. And I guess it's there to satisfy the funders. But ultimately, the wonderful thing about basic science is that it is such a black swan phenomenon, and one finds things while one is studying A that may contribute to fundamental breakthroughs unexpectedly for X, Y, and Z. A deepening understanding of the world, how it works both at the molecular and at the macroscopic level, informs our ability to navigate within it safely and productively. Staying on the genetic thread, this next study looks at a network of 9 genes that have been derived from studying a family of 5,000 people who live in Colombia, South America. The Colombian family is afflicted by a type of hereditary Alzheimer's. They're a unique resource because they are such a large, close-knit family group and live in a specific region in the western mountains of Colombia. Studying the variable ages of the onset of dementia in this family, rather than trying to treat the symptoms, the researchers have been able to look at changes in the brain that begin as early as the age of 20. They identified 9 different genes. The presence or absence of specific variants of these genes influence whether or not the individual develops Alzheimer's at an early or a later age by a very great deal. In fact, one of the genes delayed the onset of Alzheimer's by 17 years on the average when it was present. Others were identified to speed up the process. Research will need to continue on other family cohorts before we can really target the specific genes that may need to be silenced, possibly using molecular machines with structured messenger RNA to block the production of certain proteins. Maybe the therapy will involve amplifying the genes so that more protective proteins are produced. The fact is, we are entering into an era where we can begin to manipulate using injectable RNA or specially constructed molecular machines to retard or advance the production of certain proteins. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. We have new projects in the works, and I have good news. It looks like we'll probably be back on the air as of the first Saturday in July. Watch the website for more news about that. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.